This Hedgecoup series of podcasts is produced by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedgecoup. This is your Hedgecoup master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. And today we are looking at Wexford in the revolutionary decade. Apart from its significant 1798 legacy, Wexford has the distinction of being one of the few counties outside Dublin that saw action during the 1916 rising. It was also the birthplace of John Redmond, whose Irish Parliamentary Party maintained a substantial level of support throughout the revolutionary period. And we're joined by Bernard Brown, author of County Wexford in the 1916 Rising, The Literary Legacy, published by Pike Press in 2015. Ida Milne, who lectures in history at Carlow College, and who is the author of Stacking the Coffins, Influenza, War and Revolution in Ireland, 1918 to 1919, published by Manchester University Press in 2018. William Murphy is Associate Professor in the School of History and Geography in DCU's St. Patrick's Campus, Drumcondra. And finally, Kevin Whelan, the Colossus of Clonegal himself, Director of the Notre Dame Dublin Global Gateway. And this podcast is supported by Wexford County Council Public Library Service and the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Kevin, can I go to you first just to give listeners a general outline, but 2 minutes, you know, an outline. What type of a county was Wexford in terms of its geography, its economy, and so forth?
Yeah, well, Wexford is distinctive because even though it was part of Leinster, it still had a very strong tradition of the 1798 rebellion, very strong sense of who it was, historically speaking. So it was much less, shall we say, reticent than, say, counties like Kildare or Carlow, places which had been in the Pale longer. Remember, North Wexford was Gaelic and Irish-speaking and very strongly so until into the 17th century. So Wexford also had the trauma of the North Wexford plantation to deal with and had a very large and significant and important Protestant population, especially in North Wexford. The other side of Wexford was that it was unlike, say, the west coast of Ireland or whatever, it was very prosperous in terms of farming, had done well out of the First World War, really. It was Napoleon who said, an army marches on its belly. So the Wexford farmers were doing well out of the farming. Wexford maybe had less emigration than most counties. So it was relatively speaking, it was a prosperous county, but it had a strong class division between the agricultural labourers. Remember before, agriculture mechanized. If you wanted that and done, it was a guy with a spade who was doing it for you. So there was lots of agricultural labourers. You had a very strong divide as well. It's still there in Wexford, really, between North Wexford, South Wexford, and West Wexford. New Ross looks more to Munster. Gorey looks more up towards Wicklow and Wicklow and Dublin. Enniscorthy is very much the heart of the radical tradition in Wexford. And then Wexford Town and the South has, as names like Bernard Brown on the panel might suggest, has that Norman connection and, you know, was English-speaking very early on and had a very different political culture and tradition, which fed right through into the whole Redmondite tradition in Wexford politics as well. So the county was split in that kind of way as well. And then, of course, as you mentioned in your beginning, Enniscorthy prided itself after 1916 on having actually taken a stand, unlike many other places in the country. And there was a very strong divide between what Wexford Town did, which was basically to side with Redmond and the British, and what Enniscorthy did, which was basically to try to do something.
Kevin, was there a small-scale industrial part of the economy in Wexford? I'm thinking of Pierce's, you know, yes, agricultural machinery production. Yeah, that's unique for most counties, I'd say.
It is, yeah. Well, it's not all that unique. Most towns at that stage, think of Arklow with the Kinnock ammunition factory, which did really well during the First World War. But like Wexford, obviously had the Pierces and the Doyles and other families who were very entrepreneurial and, you know, who were in what we would now call agribusiness. And Wexford always had the strong milling, malting kind of tradition as well, feeding Dublin into insolence, as it were. But you know, but Wexford Town had the same thing there because it had that working class. It did have a radical tradition, and there was a bit of a lockout in Wexford in 1911 as well. So you know, there was that radical working class tradition there, which was also there in Enniscorthy, like the Shannon and areas like that would not have felt totally comfortable with, say, Main Street Enniscorthy. There was a strong class division always present in Wexford in both the rural and the urban areas, and that showed in this period as well.
Now, William, can I bring in you in? Because Kevin has painted a picture of diversity, really, in terms of economy. I'm assuming that was reflected in the political arena. Just talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevin has mentioned the Redmondite tradition in Wexford, and clearly John Redmond himself was from Wexford, Ballytrent, near Rosslare. His father had been an MP, and he himself became an MP for New Ross in 1881, and subsequently he represented North Wexford in the late 1880s and into the early 90s. He had resigned his seat to contest Parnell's seat in 1891, early in 1892, and he had failed to win that seat, but he'd subsequently won a seat in Wexford. So from that point on, he's not based in Wexford himself as an MP, but still, you know, he's a very strong Wexford base, particularly in the south of the county, as Kevin mentioned. Peter French is the Irish Party MP throughout the period in Wexford South. He's from a farming background, and he's a local magistrate and a coroner. And in the north of the county, then, that tradition is represented by the Esmond family. So Sir Thomas Esmond is the Irish Party MP. He had started out representing South Dublin, and he'd also represented West Kerry, but he'd finally taken up the North Wexford seat in 1900, and he'd hold it right through to 1918, obviously, to that pivotal general election. And I suppose, you know, like Redmond, he himself is from a landed background, a tradition in the family of serving in the British military forces, but also very nationalist and of a, you know, a Catholic, coming out of a Catholic tradition. Esmond was made chamberlain to the Vatican household at some point in the early 20th century. So there's a very strong sense of a Catholic identity there. He's interesting because he sort of fluctuates a little bit between the Irish Party, and he's tempted to join Sinn Féin in the early days of Sinn Féin's arrival. He briefly does, in fact, but he doesn't resign his seat, unlike Dolan in Leitrim. He retains his seat, and then he has a change of heart and he re-enters the Irish Party quite quickly. But during that period, he founds the Enniscorthy Echo with William Sears in 1902. And Enniscorthy Echo really as a paper is very interesting because it becomes a site of sort of radical Republican ideas in Wexford right through from 1907, 1908 under Sears' editorship. It becomes a space where a group of radicals collect together around Sears, like Sean Etchingham and Ada Blockham and Bob Brennan and Larry De Lacy. And indeed, even people like Sean Hegarty, who's on the run from Cork in 1915, have been thrown out of the county because of his radical activities there, moves to Enniscorthy and works for the paper. So it becomes a very important centre for radical ideas. And it's the first local newspaper in the country to support Sinn Féin. So there's a sort of a burgeoning Sinn Féin structure in the county. The Echo, for instance, will publish the Irish Citizen, which is the radical suffrage newspaper from this period from 1912 on. And it'll also publish the Irish Volunteer newspaper when it's established to support that movement in 1914. And then, you know, Kevin has also mentioned in conversation with you, you talked about the sort of industry in Wexford Town. And in that context, a sort of trade union tradition emerges quite early there as well. In 1911, really, you can see it emerging quite strongly. As the ITGWU begins to emerge, then some of the employers in the town decide they're going to try and put a stop to this, and they lock out the workers. First, the Doyles lock their workers out of Selscar's ironworks, and then the Pierces, and that's followed by other engineering works and flour mills in the town. And there's a pretty serious labour conflict in the town, which lasts right through from August 1911 through to February 1912. And it's eventually settled, in fact, with a victory for the workers when the employers concede that they should have a union which emerged called the Irish Foundry Workers Union, which is really an affiliate of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. And Richard Corrish becomes its secretary, and Corrish is a significant figure in subsequent decades, particularly in the Wexford Labour tradition.
Kevin, you wanted to come in there?
Two other points that are worth making there is, number one, as William was saying, the Catholic Church was very strong in Wexford. Wexford produced more vocations, as they used to be called back in the day, more vocations than any other county. A very strong Catholic Church, very strong leaders, but very Redmondite in their political orientation. So Redmond was very closely tied to the Catholic Church, and that's one aspect of it. But the other side of Wexford was that there was also very strong and early adoption of the GAA. And ironically, even though Wexford hadn't really been Irish-speaking since the late 18th, early 19th century, very strong Gaelic League activity. Wexford had one of the highest concentrations of Gaelic League branches in the country. So you had that was also coming into play then. This Gaelic, the GAA, remember Wexford had a four in a row in Gaelic football in this period as well. Strong GAA, which was nationalising people as well. Very strong Catholic Church on the other side. And really Redmond and others, and this is where the point of conflict came in, and William talked very well about the role of the Echo there, but that they were also anti-imperial, whereas Redmond was keen, very keen on the British Empire. What he wanted was equal participation of Catholics, no discrimination against Catholics in the Empire, but he wasn't against Empire per se, whereas this group of radicals like the Brennan and Etchingham and those, rooted really in Enniscorthy, they were vehemently Republican, anti-monarchical, anti-imperial. And Redmond really allowed himself to become old-fashioned in this period in terms of his ardent desire to stay connected with the British Empire.
Ida, I want to bring you in on the Protestant population. This was mentioned by Kevin earlier. Again, that's somewhat unusual for a county outside of Ulster. Just talk to us about this. I mean, I want to be careful what I say here. I mean, was there a unionist tradition on the ground politically? And I know Protestant doesn't necessarily mean unionist, because I know in 98 the Protestant population was somewhat divided on this question. Where did they stand in the county?
Well, let me just backtrack for a second to go back to a point that both Kevin and Will have been making about the Echo and about its radical tradition. And one of the ways that they express that radical tradition, and it's illuminating in the context of COVID really, was in an anti-vaccination campaign, which was expressed across the pages of the Echo. And I just thought it was an interesting point. It was anti-imperial culture and against the compulsory smallpox vaccination. In terms of the Protestant population in Wexford, there is about 8,000 members in the 1911 census, would be members of the Church of Ireland community. There would be about 400 Presbyterians and about 300 Methodists, as I remember, out of an overall population of about 102,000. And so the Protestant population is probably about 7-8% of the total. Quite a strong population, but quite diverse politically. In terms of what they do, they're involved in the merchant community in all the main towns, businesses like Cooks and Gorey, or businesses in shops in Enniscorthy and in Wexford Town. Wexford Town itself, I think, judging by the composition of the local Board of Guardians, is quite unionist in the 1910s. And that is definitely a difference between the composition of the Boards of Guardians in Enniscorthy and Uros, etc., even though they do have Protestant members on them.
Just to clarify this, there is an explicitly unionist constituency, say, at local election level.
It would seem that. I'm not sure whether Will and Kevin and Bernard would agree with that or not, but certainly in the composition of the Wexford Board of Guardians, it seems some of the views that they express, for example, at the time of the Great Flu, are quite unionist. Bernard has something I think he wants to add in there.
Yeah, Bernard, can I bring you in on that?
In terms of the unionist tradition in Wexford, I mean, the last unionist candidate for the Imperial Parliament, as it was then, was Barrett Hamilton. And that was, about 1895. And a unionist candidate never stood for in County Wexford after that. I think he only got about 750 votes in the general in that election in the 1890s. And there wasn't, and he was quite a well-known character because he was an internationally known mammalogist, and he was well regarded internationally as a scientist. But there was never any candidates, maybe just at local election, but certainly not in general election.
Tommy is looking back at, through my own family and what they would talk about political affiliations in that period, is that they would be broadly IPP. I don't think they would extend to Sinn Féin. But the other sense is that they had learned from 1798 to be quite apolitical.
Well, that segues into my next question to Kevin, back to you, is, you know, how significant was the memory of 98? Because I'm conscious that the centenary commemorations in 1998 were very important in people like James Connolly, Maud Gonne, who were to become prominent later. So how significant was it? I mean, my supplementary question is, was it more Father Murphy than Wolfe Tone in the way it was remembered?
Yeah, well, I did the 1898 centenary, never mind in Wexford, where it was, shall we say, enthusiastically celebrated. 1898 celebration was really, really important for this reason. Remember that 1897 was the death of Queen Victoria, and she'd been on the throne since what?
No, the Jubilee, Kevin. No, it was the Jubilee. No,
she died. But anyway, 1897 had been the Jubilee of Queen Victoria. And from a nationalist point of view, they'd been fighting over Parnell, and they took, as we'd say nowadays, they took their eye off the ball. And when the Victoria Jubilee came around, 60 years on the throne since 1837, there was Union Jacks coming out your wazoo in Dublin, especially Grafton Street, Trinity College, all that area. And if you looked at Dublin at that stage, you would say this is a contented provincial city like Edinburgh or Shrewsbury or somewhere. Not there's nothing wrong with those towns or cities. But the point being then, the nationalists had to kind of, as we'd say, up their game. So in 1898, the idea was that they would wipe that stain of looking like a contented loyalist a part of the British Empire. And that's why people like James Connolly, Maud Gonne, Lord Moore got involved in it. And then the other thing that happened was in 1899, you had the first Boer War or the second Boer War. Now, the point about that was this was the first really significant anti-imperial movement by an Anglophone population and a white population, to put it crudely. And it fed absolutely into the emergent narrative that Ireland wasn't alone in terms of feeling oppressed by the British Empire. So, you know, you got the twin track, 1897, then the centenary, which reorients, reboots, recharges, redynamizes Irish nationalism, and then you got this boost to anti-imperialism with the Boer War, and that's when Maud Gonne and others begin to proselytize against British recruitment, very successfully actually, in Dublin and elsewhere. So the mood begins to change, and it changed most dramatically in Wexford. The big thing they were doing in Wexford was putting up all the monuments, including some very fine ones, like the Father Murphy one in Enniscorthy and the Croppy By one down in Wexford town. Very fine monuments by Oliver Shepherd.
So, Kevin, just to clarify, these monuments only went up in living memory of people around in the revolutionary period. So they were new.
Yeah, but Wexford was prosperous, but it wasn't so prosperous that it took years to get the money to put up those monuments. And they were the first nationalist monuments, the first time that monuments went up to, and we know statues are important. We've seen it in the recent past. Last year or two, but like for nationalists, they were massive, and all the unveilings of those monuments attracted crowds of 20,000-30,000 people to Enniscorthy and to Wexford, and they were what we would call consciousness raising. But they were very much within, and this is where the Catholic Church in Redmond were very keen to steer it. Redmond initially was skeptical about the centenary, but then he knew that if he didn't get involved in it, he'd be toast. So he did get involved and managed to bring out ancestors who had actively been involved in 98, even though his own family were more involved with the yeomanry, Catholics who were in the yeomanry rather than radicals. But it did create a big change, Tommy.
Kevin, I just remember William wants to come in at this point. William.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin has just mentioned something which I think is important in it, is that clearly he's absolutely right that 1798 gives centenary gives a huge boost to radicalism and radical nationalism in Ireland in particular and in Wexford. But, you know, mainstream nationalism also is very involved in attempts to incorporate the commemoration inside its story as well. So, I mean, if you take, for instance, the Esmonds in North Wexford, Sir Thomas Esmond would have had ancestors who were involved in the yeomanry on one side, but he very much chose to emphasize also an ancestor who was killed on the rebel side in 1798. And he was a chairperson of various committees seeking to put up some of the monuments that Kevin mentioned there. And I suppose one of the things, I don't want to anticipate where we might go, but one thing that's important is those statues, once they come up, actually become sites of contest during the revolutionary period. So they become spaces where, for instance, tricolours are erected at key moments on key dates, and you find the RIC or later the army coming in to take down those tricolours, and then finding the following morning they've been erected again. So the monuments, their moment of erection is important in terms of political activity and the kind of politics they stimulate, but they also become an ongoing site of political contest as well.
Bernard, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, I think that point that Kevin made earlier there about the monuments is really important, because, I mean, the first monument, I think Kevin was up in your neck of the woods, up in Bunclody direction, 1875. And then you had something, the Dublin Wexford Association had a monument that was erected in Boule of Ogue later on than that. But the Irish, to come back to William's point there earlier, the Irish Parliamentary Party certainly got on the bandwagon very quickly. And you had mentioned earlier there about Peter French. Peter French is an interesting character in that he became involved in politics as a result of John Barry resigning in 1893 after the Home Rule Bill was didn't deliver, and he was some way related to that John Barry as well. But Barry was the man who first elected Parnell, who first proposed Parnell as leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party. And later, in Committee Room 15, he was one of the people who denounced him being cited in the divorce case. And Peter French then took the seat there. And French, definitely a lot more than John Redmond, French used his 98 connections, as Lawrence French, one of his ancestors, was out in 98. And he certainly on all the unveilings and that, you had the Irish Parliamentary Party, three or four of them sitting there. And all, as Kevin said, they're talking about their ancestry, you know, and involvements in 98. But French is well worth having a look at some stage or other.
Kevin, you want to come in there? Kevin, just I don't anticipate what you want to say here, but what strikes me now, what everyone's saying here, is that everybody wanted a peace in 98, right? That, and this leads me to my next point, that has the distinction between constitutional and revolutionary nationalism been too sharply drawn? In other words, like, Redmondites were just as likely to celebrate the Manchester Martyrs 98 as Sinn Féin supporters.
Yeah, for sure, because they were looking for home rule, and they wanted to, they certainly wanted to project the fact that all Ireland was in favour of this. And as I said, like, healing the Parnellite split was really important. It was in the 1898 commemorations that for the first time, these people who had been absolutely vitriolic towards each other had now came together again on a common platform. So that really helped. But remember, this is a generational shift too, Tommy. In 1875, when the monument was erected at Boule of Ogue to Father John Murphy, the Catholic bishop at the time absolutely didn't want it, didn't want anything to do with it, forced all the publicans to close down, a little bit like today when many Wexford people have suspicions about Dublin people coming down and spreading COVID or doing anything else. At that time, the idea was these bloody Dublin people are coming down. And so when they came down on the train and then marched from Ferns to Boule of Ogue, the bishop had closed down all the pubs and told the locals to have nothing to do with these Dublin devils. But by 1898, that had shifted dramatically. And, you know, although Redmond, you know, moved in, he wasn't really all that enthusiastic about it. It was more that he knew that this thing had the capacity to derail him, whereas the really radical ones were getting involved. And remember, Tommy, this is also the period, and we didn't mention this and we should, this is the period when what is now the Irish Country Women's Association was founded by Wexford people, some from the great Wexford Protestant tradition. Women are getting involved in trade unions. Women are beginning to go to public commemorations like the 1898 one, and women are beginning to challenge the idea that they should, you know, just be kids, kitchen, church. They're beginning to get involved in politics. And Redmond was very slow, I think, to read that shift in the mood. So 1898, but also the Boer War, then the beginnings of Sinn Féin in 1905, the rise of the trade union movement, the Dublin lockout, all of this is creating a groundswell of opinion. But I think it's very generational, like that the older people don't understand this. The younger people are what we would now say a woke generation. They're very fired up about this. And Wexford is very, very involved because there's that pride in what we had done. Using the royal we here, what we had done in 98. Despite my age, I wasn't actually out in 98.
Yes. William, you want to come in on that?
Just very briefly, just a note, again, following up on Kevin's point, that the Echo and William Sears as editor was very strongly pro women's suffrage. I mentioned already that they, at their print works, the Irish Citizen, which was the suffrage newspaper, was, they printed it for the Irish Women's Franchise League, but you know, in the pages of their own paper, the Echo, they very firmly supported women's suffrage in this period.
Now, William, Redmond, of course, made his famous speech at Wooden Bridge in 1914, calling on the Irish volunteers to join the British Army. How many answered the call in Wexford? What was the involvement recruitment like in the British Army in Wexford?
Well, Tommy, I can't give you an exact figure, but what I can say to you is that...
It's about 500 I have here in my notes. I mean, that looks substantial to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixed picture. And again, this is back to something Kevin has mentioned already in terms of the diversity of the county. So as in much of Ireland, in rural areas, recruitment was reasonably slow. You know, there was no great incentive from young men in agricultural families to join up. They were doing very well as a consequence of the war. There was a boom in Irish agriculture, and there's very, very low recruitment out of farming background. I mean, that's true in England and Wales and Scotland as well. Recruitment out of people from farming backgrounds is lower than in towns and cities. There's more substantial recruitment in Wexford out of, you know, the bigger towns like Wexford and Enniscorthy. For instance, when the British Legion did a survey in the early 1930s, and this is, you know, I'm borrowing from the work of Pauline Codd here, there were just under 250 men who at that stage were in Enniscorthy town who had served in the British Army during the First World War. So quite substantial numbers. And as far as I know, if I remember correctly, there are just over 200 men from Wexford who died during the war. One of the things that's interesting is once matters begin to radicalize in 1916, 1917. One of the interesting contests in sort of working class districts of towns like Wexford and Enniscorthy is between working people, labouring people who have turned towards the, you know, the increasingly popular radical Sinn Féin Irish Volunteers movement, and those who still have an affiliation towards the British Army and towards the Union Jack as a consequence of family members, husbands who are still on the Western Front. So you find actually cases coming up in the local courts because with neighbours suing each other because of conflict in the street and assaults, because of rows associated with this differing view on either membership of the British Army in support of the war or the sort of growing radical movement in Ireland.
Now, I'm just keeping an eye on the time here. And Bernard, I want to bring you in this because especially for our non-Wexford listeners, Could you just give us a basic narrative of, you know, what happened in 1916, or why was it that you know, uniquely, apart from Galway, there was a turnout in 1916 in Wexford. Bernard, just give us a brief outline of what happened.
Yeah, just really quickly there, just what Will mentioned there, there was about 800 Wexford people, from County Wexford who were killed in the First World War. And in total throughout the whole county, and which is quite a sizable number. I suppose just in terms of why Wexford rose in 1916, I mean the Irish Volunteers set up in Dublin in November of 1913, and there was a branch immediately set up in Enniscorthy within about 3 weeks, and it was infiltrated very quickly by the IRB. And as Kevin has alluded to earlier, I mean, Enniscorthy had always been the kind of nucleus of a kind of activism, and that there was a very strong IRB presence in Enniscorthy. I think there was over maybe 120 men who were members of the IRB in Enniscorthy. And they were also supported by some of the clergy, you know, the priest who had Pat Murphy. He was known as 98 Murphy. He was a cleric who supported the Irish Volunteers and the IRB. And they were, you know, they had active units throughout Ferns, where Brennan Whitmore was from, and from other areas around the county. And they were, I mean, they held the town, I suppose, during the rebellion, but Bernard, for about 5 days.
Sorry to interject here, Bernard. I'm just interested in the logistics of this, right? Because other counties would have got the countermanding order from MacNeill and stayed at home, right?
Yes, yes.
My speculation has always been that in Dublin, it basically depended on how far you could get on a bicycle, you know, to let people know that it was back on again
yes,
the following
yeah.
day. Now, but Wexford is a lot more than a bicycle ride.
Well,
how did it
was a bicycle that was a result of Wexford actually rising. In that, I mean,
really. So my
the countermanding order had been received in Wexford, and you had people like Jim Ryan going to Cork and his sister, and then you had Peter Paul Galligan who went to Dublin, and he actually cycled back to Wexford with orders from, I think it was Connolly and Pierce. He met both of them to say that the rising was on, and he had to circumvent Dublin, and I think he had about a 150 or 175 mile cycle from Dublin back to Wexford to Enniscorthy to say the rising was on. And he gave the orders to Seamus O'Doole in Enniscorthy. And as I say, the rest is history, in that they held the town for 5 days. And there was a few casualties, just people wounded in the town. And they flew the tricolour, of course, in Enniscorthy and all the rest of it. And 150 of them ended up in Frongoch. And that was to have a huge impact on them going forward. But in terms of, they didn't have, their arms were very limited. They only had 20 or 30 rifles, but they had a lot of ammunition. And they were told to hold the ammunition or to use it sparingly, despite the fact that, and Kevin has alluded to this and yourself earlier, in relation to Wexford with its agricultural background and all the rest of it, you have places like Pierce's and Doyle's, and you had Bulgers and Ferns who were supplying armaments to the Kimmage garrison, Joseph Mary Plunkett's garrison in Dublin. As well, they were sending up hand grenades and casings for munitions. So it's a very complex story, and you have a lot of complex characters there involved as well. Like Brendan Whitmore, you had, the names are just slipping out of my head here at the moment as I'm thinking.
Tell you what, you gather your thoughts, Bernard. I just bring Kevin wanted to come in on that. Kevin.
Yeah, but the fact that Enniscorthy was on the train track was really important, because speakers could come down from Dublin. And if you look through the year or two before 1916, people like Pierce had given the Emmett Memorial Lecture in the Athenaeum, which was the headquarters in 1916, in 1915. And, you know, he had stressed in that talk, he stressed the fact that what really mattered now was to take a stand. It was, you know, Pierce is sometimes seen to have had a martyrdom complex or whatever. I'm not so sure that's the case, but he was dead set on making a stand. He didn't believe that it was necessary to win, and he was right about this, actually. He believed that what was really important was to take the stand. And in Wexford, in Enniscorthy, he had a receptive audience for that. There was a hardcore of Fenians. There was a hardcore of IRB, very tough families like the Keegans there in Irish Street, who were really the backbone of the whole kind of thing. So it wasn't that Wexford also had it. That idea was embedded in Wexford. It's still there in Wexford that we led in 1798. And if something happens now, it will be a disgrace if we don't take part. And they did for that reason.
Just before I bring William in at this point, doesn't it demonstrate, though, what might have happened if there hadn't been a countermanding order, and what might have happened might have been not that much because of the lack of arms? William, you want to comment on that? You know, because, I mean, once they took Enniscorthy, it was very little they could do. But it did demonstrate the weakness in terms of the arms, so the Oud had been intercepted and so on.
I mean, in some senses, I suppose what happened was, I don't want to denigrate it, but the symbolism of it was almost as important as what they could effectively do in militaristic terms, I suppose, Tommy, in response to that point. But I would say as well that Fergal McGarry has made, I think, an important point about why Enniscorthy perhaps rose when other places didn't. And he makes the point that in Enniscorthy, at least they received what he described as clear and realistic instructions. And this is back to the railway line. They were asked to try and cut the railway line and essentially prevent the movement of troops from the south up along the railway line to Dublin. So they you know, there was realistic instructions, and those instructions had a purpose, as well as the tradition in the town and the sense of it being symbolically important to hold the town and to act as previous generations had done. And it's very interesting, you know, it's quite an ascetic rebellion in Enniscorthy. One of the first things they do, for instance, is they close down the pubs. So there's a very clear sense they want to communicate that this is a controlled, well-directed, purposeful, serious activity that they're engaging in.
Kevin, you want to come in there very quickly, because I want to move on to the 1918 election. Kevin, you want to make a quick comment?
Enniscorthy sent a contingent to the funeral of O'Donovan Rossa, which was definitely like a major trigger point. And they came back from that absolutely kind of fired up as well. But you have to remember, too, like people could make political choices for all kinds of reasons. Like one of my family, Miles Murphy, who was an agricultural laborer from the watch house there just outside Donegal, he joined up essentially because he was unemployed. He was killed in the blood, mud and piss of Flanders for no good reason. And the only thing that came back to his family, this was in 1916, ironically, was the newspaper report that he had of Wexford winning the All-Ireland from the self-same Echo newspaper. The Wexford newspapers weren't reporting the GA much at that stage, but the Echo did. But you know what I mean? Like somebody like that, was he pro-British? You know, was he fighting in the wrong army in the wrong war? But like his motivation really, as far as I can deduce, was to make a few bob. And for those 800 Wexford men, and they were all men who fought in the First World War, really, like when you look at it, there's been a lot of hoo-ha in recent years about acknowledging and recognizing those, and that's important. But you can overdo it, because the First World War was an absolutely ridiculous, stupid, morally and ethically bankrupt war. And, you know, one should never glorify it. Whatever about the people who lost their lives, it was a complete waste of human endeavor, and millions and millions of young Europeans died for no good reason except for imperialism. And that's what turned a lot of people against imperialism after the war, when Ireland became one of the first parts of the British Empire to fall off.
Hey, I just want to move things on here. Maybe I'll go to you, William, on this. Just what happened in the 1918 general election, right? Because there were two constituencies in Wexford, North and South. I mean, two fairly close contests, as I understand it. William?
Reasonably so, closer in the south than in the north. In the north, it was contested between Roger Sweetman for Sinn Féin and Thomas Esmond, who attempted to try and hold his seat and failed to do so. Sweetman had a majority of about 3,000. Sweetman was a late selection and a rather unenthusiastic candidate. They had attempted to convince Seamus Doyle, a local man, to be the candidate, first of all, for North Wexford, and then he refused. After that, they'd asked John Sweetman, who had been a figure in the early days of Sinn Féin and actually had been a close associate of Esmond back in, you know, around the foundation of the county councils in Ireland in the late 1890s. But he again said he was too old. And then finally, and rather desperately, really, in some ways, they turned to Roger Sweetman, who was a cousin of John Sweetman and also a cousin of Father John F. Sweetman, who was the headmaster of Mount St. Benedict College, which was based in North Wexford and which was another sort of centre of radical ideas in the county. But Sweetman won. You know, I think his cousin's assistance, Father John F., was very important, as well as just the general strength of radicalism in the north of the county. And then James Ryan won in the south, defeating Peter French. But again, Peter French put up a fair old struggle to hang on to his seat. And, you know, there was just about 500 votes between them, which was a very, very strong performance by an Irish party candidate comparatively, if you look across the country.
Now, what about the local elections, William? Sorry, Bernard, do you want to come in there very quickly?
Yeah, it's interesting. Will is there talking about Jem Ryan. I mean, Jem Ryan always said that the reason that he got elected in 1918, in December 1918, was as a result of the Spanish flu, because he had returned to Wexford after being released from prison, and he had set up a medical practice in Wexford. He had been in the GPO in 1916 as the medical officer there, and he had set up his medical practice in Wexford, and he went around South Wexford treating people for Spanish flu, and he said that's how he was so well known and got elected.
Ida, mention of flu, I have to bring you in here on this. Like, how did Wexford fare in relation to the big the Spanish flu pandemic, 1918-1919?
It's a really interesting point, and it's one that was not replicated at Waterford, where the local doctor actually lost the election despite having done heroic stuff during the flu. His name escapes me right at the moment, very well-known character in Waterford city politics. In Wexford, there were 566 deaths attributed directly to flu, and I estimate that about 23,000 caught it over the more or less May 1918 through April 1919, which covers the three waves of the flu in Ireland. Probably a lot more than that caught and died from it, because people were dying so fast, people hadn't enough time to do the paperwork. The disease really came in first into Gorey, which had, you know, the closer rail link to Dublin, and Uros, which is a port town. And Uros was also a barracks town, so there's a lot of interconnection between barracks and the flu. But it quite quickly spread to Wexford town and to Enniscorthy. Enniscorthy seemed to delay it a good bit by doing a street disinfection and closing businesses and disinfecting them. And there was a very strong consciousness in the town of wearing things like eucalyptus in the scarves and things like that. You see whole families coming down with it and some dying from it. You see a lot of shopkeepers getting it. It's anybody really who worked in a job that dealt with the public would suffer very badly. So that would include people like newspaper workers, printers, journalists, priests. There's loads of talk of priests in the Wexford papers, like Canon O'Connor, the parish priest of Portnacuddy, and his curate Albert Lennon going down with it, Aidan McCormack of Kilteely. You see two members of the Art McMurrah Pipers Band, which is legendary in Wexford at the time, both shop assistants, Edward Wright and Joseph O'Leary, die for it. Then you see Mrs. Murphy in Patrick Street in Enniscorthy and her son Edward dying the same hour from it. And there's lots of talk then, of course, about its impact on the All-Ireland as well. And while we got the four in a row, and of this we are very, very proud, we got it in part because a very strong Kildare team, which went on to win the following year, were knocked out very early by it.
It sounds like you're going native there in Kildare, where you're associated.
Well, I was for a long time married to somebody who wrote the Kildare history of the GA, so it's something that I was often not forgiven for.
No, because I did a Hesfield recently in Tip to do Bloody Sunday, the Tip connection, but they're firmly convinced that they were robbed in 1918. Because some of their key players went down with
absolutely.
The flu.
Davy Tolan, their star player, their key point scorer, had gone down with the flu. It's not a popular thing to say in Wexford, and in fairness, it was their fourth, so they might have won it, but they did get assistance with the flu. The flu works in mysterious ways at times.
I tell you what, let's go away from the controversy or back to kind of more or less controversial things, actually. William, I had attempted to ask you a question there, a follow-up question on elections, the local elections 1920, because I'm assuming that it's a much more diverse picture on the ground in the local elections.
Well, the local elections, and maybe some of the others might want to come in a little bit more on the south of the county, but in particular in the north, very clearly there's a transfer of power at a local election level. For instance, if you take Enniscorthy UDC, you get, and it's very firmly presented at this, you get a coalition of Sinn Féin and Labour taking control of the Urban District Council in Enniscorthy. And you know, David Fitzpatrick once famously talked about what happened in Ireland in these years as old wine being poured into new bottles, in the sense that what you had is a transfer of allegiance from former Irish Party supporters onto the Sinn Féin ticket, and the people who represented Sinn Féin were more or less the same kind of people who represented the Irish Party a little earlier. And I think that's not quite true. If you look at Enniscorthy Urban District Council, there's definitely a switch from the sort of business, rather more moneyed Catholic middle class to a sort of perhaps a lower middle class and labouring background getting elected onto the Urban District Council in early 1920. And then if you look at the county council as well for later in the year, coming out of the kind of Enniscorthy district, you have again a combination of Sinn Féin, two Sinn Féin candidates and two Labour candidates getting elected onto the county council.
Bernard, do you want to come in there?
Just something earlier there that I think it was Will or Kevin mentioned about Gorey and Mount St. Benedict and Sweetman. I mean, Mount St. Benedict's in Gorey was really a hotbed there. It was a boarding school set up, and it was Sweetman of Dom Sweetman, the prior or whatever there was an amazing character, and he was related to John Sweetman. But some of the students who went to school there include James Dillon, later leader of Fine Gael, and also Maud Gonne's son, MacBride. John MacBride was a pupil there, along with a lot of other well-known characters. But one of the women who was really important there was Comerford, Mary Comerford. She was Sweetman's right hand, and she went on to write an account about the first Dáil in 1969, and was a lifelong supporter of Sinn Féin. And she was really, really, really important. And she was certainly just again one of these forgotten people from the area. But my other point was there was a huge number of women who voted in 1918, and that had a major impact on the election. And you also had an awful lot of women who had been radicalized in the period from 1916 to 1918, who took a really strong canvassing role during the election. And I think that's something that's forgotten sometimes, that you had people like Nell Ryan of Tom Cool and Kathleen Brown, who had both been imprisoned for long periods of time during the rebellion, or in the aftermath of the rebellion, who played a very strong part in the election of both Sweetman in North Wexford and also with Jim Ryan in Wexford. And Ryan went on to become a very important Fianna Fáil government minister later. And T.K. Whitaker can thank him for all the work that he did in allowing him to put his name to that report, which was published, in the 1950s?
Ida, you want to come in, and then I'll go to Kevin. Ida.
Just to add to what Bernard is saying, that the role of sweetening is almost legendary in Wexford, and it's something that, you know, as school children brought up in Wexford, two things were mentioned to us. One was sweetening, and the other was that we would be taken at least once a year on a pilgrimage to one of those 1798 sites. So they're the kind of part of the way the mythology keeps going throughout Wexford society. And I think it's also really important to mention the role that women played during the war effort too. There was across Enniscorthy, Wexford and Gorey, I think there were locations where women got together and did things like making bandages and care packs and comfort packs for, you know, their beloveds who were away at the war. And I'm particularly remembering at this time when I'm thinking of my grandaunts, Ida and Etty, who were young women at the war, another Ida Milton. And, you know, when we looked through their effects when they died in the 1970s, we found an awful lot of memorabilia from, you know, boyfriends who'd gone off to the war, buttons and tokens of their esteem and postcards home and things like that. So that's also interwoven through the memory of what's going on, you know, in Wexford in this period.
Kevin, you want to come in?
Yeah, just a couple of very quick, and these are very Wexford-related points. The Ryans of Tom Cool, major league family, and so involved in so many ways with brilliant women in the family as well. But they went on, like, really to backbone the new Free State. And indeed, I would point out as a Wexford person that James Ryan, who plays in the Irish rugby team now, is, you know, of that family. Andrew Porter, another member of that team, is his father's from Donegal. Just don't forget that. And of course, we have the great Tadhg Furlong as well. So three of the current Irish rugby team have strong Wexford connections. The Benedictines are interesting because this is one of the great might have beens. The Irish sisters or the Irish nuns, the Benedictine community at Ypres, which was destroyed in the First World War, they were repatriated out. They had to come back to Ireland. It was John Redmond who fixed them up, and he got them into MacMine, just outside Enniscorthy there. But when Redmond died, the Benedictines, I think, maybe didn't feel the love so much in Wexford, and they removed themselves to where they still are in Kylemore, where they're enjoying their 100th anniversary of moving there. But that wonderful boarding school at Kylemore could have been in Wexford. And then to revert to the point that Bernard and Will have been stressing, it's important to remember that the county council framework came into being in 1898 as well. And that was really a training ground for politics. So you have all these new, you know, county councillors, you have people involved in politics, you have a broadening of the political base, women get to vote, which was really important, and then you get a widening of the franchise. But what all of it shows is that when push came to shove in Wexford, as elsewhere in Ireland, there was an overwhelming democratic mandate for Ireland leaving Britain.
Okay, William, I want to move on because we're in danger of doing Shakespeare about the fifth act here. I want to move on to the War of Independence itself. And how did Wexford perform? I'm expecting two answers to this question. One is, like, what was the debt toll? But that's only part of the story. The other is, how did it perform in terms of the counter-state, you know, Dáil courts, that sort of activity?
Well, if we look at violence as a measure of activity, then Wexford was not that violent during the War of Independence period. In the recent book on the dead of the Irish Revolution by Eoin O'Halpin and Dáil Coráin, they say that there were 23 people killed in Wexford between 1917 and 1921. A couple of those were killed before the War of Independence began at all. Very few of those are killed in sort of what you might describe as conventional conflict, the kind of conflict we expected, ambushes or raids or that kind of thing. I mean, the IRA casualties, most of them were accidental casualties. So very famously, everyone in Wexford probably knows about Salt Mills, where there was a sort of a bomb factory blew up there effectively in October 1920, and five men who were in the Ballycullen company of the IRA were killed there. Before that, in 1917, Seamus Rafter had also died in a bomb-making accident, and he was a leading figure in the IRA in Enniscorthy, or the Irish Volunteers, as it was then in Enniscorthy. And his absence is often ascribed as one of the reasons why the Irish Volunteers and IRA in North Wexford lacked the kind of dynamic leadership that might have led to high levels of violence during the War of Independence. There were a number of RIC men killed. Most famous, perhaps, is Percival Lee Wilson, who was killed in Gorey in June 1920, a combination of men from the Wexford IRA and men who came down from Dublin from the intelligence.
That was a grudge, you know. Killing,
that was definitely a grudge, yeah, as a consequence of his alleged treatment of including Tom Clark, but several others, their treatment having been captured during the 1916 rising in Dublin. And even a couple of the RIC men who were killed in Wexford actually were killed as a consequence of accidental death. So there were 9 civilians killed in Wexford during the War of Independence, and 5 of those were shot as alleged spies, which is a pretty high level.
That's pretty high for a county with low. I mean, famously, Cork has a huge level of spies and reformers, but it's got a huge level of everything, right? Whereas that's very unusual for a relatively quiet county.
It is. It's quite heavy. And most of them are from the sort of Catholic labouring classes. Quite a number of them are former British Army men, bringing us back to the World War I story. The figures do pick up, and this is not untypical. The rate of those shootings increases in 1921. And perhaps one of the reasons for this is, even though Wexford has pretty low levels of violence, Wexford is put under martial law in early 1921. And there are pretty high levels of arrests and internments from the county at that point. So that may be one of the factors that leads to the unusually high level of shooting of alleged spies and informers in the county.
What about non-violent activity?
There's quite high levels of, you know, protest. I mentioned earlier, there's a quite constant activity around contesting the spaces which are symbolic. One of the things that the Urban District Council in Enniscorthy does quite early, once it's in the control of Sinn Féin and Labour, is the renaming of the spaces. So you get Weaver Street and Rafter Street very quickly. You get, as I said, there are the targeting of, short of shooting of, but the intimidation of quite a lot of government officials takes place in this period. Local rates collectors, local courts clerks, people who are working in the local asylum system. There's a large asylum in Enniscorthy. So that kind of activity is pretty widespread.
Kevin, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, Tommy, I think the wider picture of the geography of the Civil War and the War of Independence, I think like a lot of it goes back to 1916. Because remember, as we've talked a lot about, very few places outside Dublin actually mobilised in 1916. And the dog that doesn't bark, the dog that didn't bark was Munster. Like Munster in the 19th century, if anybody had said, what is the hotbed of Irish nationalism? Where were the Fenians and all those guys? It was in Munster. And like counties like Tipperary, Cork, Limerick would have seen themselves as being, you know, bearing the nationalist crusade. And they thought of Dublin and Dubliners as a waste of space and a waste of time. So the whole point about the 1916 rising was it happened in Dublin. The Cork leadership have disgraced themselves really in terms of how they conducted themselves in 1916, from a nationalist perspective. So when the War of Independence started, they were dead keen to redeem themselves. So the longest and the toughest and the most hot and heavy period of the War of Independence was definitely in Munster. But it was the rebound from what they had done hadn't done in 1916. And of course, the corollary is true in Wexford. Wexford had been out in briefly anyway in 1916. So
Kevin, are you suggesting they're resting on their laurels a bit, Kevin?
Exactly. They're resting on their pikes because if you get the reputation of early rising, you can stay in bed all day. But it was Cork and Limerick and the Tipperary crowd who were dead keen, as I say, to kind of reassert their leadership of Irish nationalism, because, as I said, they had done sweet FA in 1916.
William, can I come back? Yeah, sorry, William, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kevin may have a point there around the sense that Enniscorthy felt it had to some extent done its bit. But again, I would come back to a certain sort of reluctance in the leadership. So, for instance, T.D. Sinnott, who was a very significant figure in the IRA in Wexford in the early period of the War of Independence. He's court-martialed by the IRA in March 1920 for effectively not pursuing the campaign as vigorously as they would like. And Sweetman, who we've mentioned, is a very, you know, he's the voice of Sinn Féin, at least to some extent, in the north of the county. And he's very quickly, very dubious about the high levels of violence that are that is taking place. And in fact, he will resign his TD-ship, MP-ship, whichever you want to describe it, in January 1921, in particular because he objects to the levels of violence that are going on in the country more broadly, obviously not in Wexford in particular.
Now, William, just to finish up here, because I want to move on to the Civil War, right? It's much more active during the Civil War. I mean, have you any idea how many were killed, roughly speaking? I know there isn't a book out on that yet. But in broad terms, how many were killed in Wexford in the Civil War?
We don't have precise figures, but more than during the War of Independence is absolutely clear. So, you know, we're certainly talking, you know, 30, more than 30 is how I would put it, Tommy. But anything else beyond that, I admit, would be speculation. But it's quite clear there. It's quite violent, particularly in the south of the county, but generally speaking. Why? Well, as I said, the South Wexford is definitely anti-treaty. It's led there by Thomas O'Sullivan, the IRA, and he's fairly active around in the New Ross area, and also Bob Lambert around Wexford town is a vigorous, Republican leader as well in this period. So that thing of leadership, I think, matters. Aaron O'Mwaney, who has written about this, has argued that one of the things that happened in Wexford is that the IRA was quite effectively organised in the truce period, and that in actual fact it was in a better position in some ways to engage in conflict following the truce due to reorganisation than it had been earlier during the War of Independence. And another factor is probably just Wexford's geography again. So in the early days of the Civil War, after the defeat of the Republicans in Dublin, one of the places they retreat towards is into Enniscorthy. So there's pretty significant conflict in Enniscorthy in early July of 1922. And then, you know, West Wexford, I suppose, to put it that way, borders on Waterford and bordering on Munster. And obviously Munster is the site of the heaviest conflict. So perhaps that proximity to Munster matters as well in this.
Bernard, you want to come in on that? Then I'll go to Kevin. Bernard?
Just in relation to that, I think what Will was saying there, Bob Lambert and all, Bob Lambert was very active in the war on the railways around the Killearn area and mid Wexford, and he had a very active unit there. And of course, three of his members were shot then by Free State execution for having been found with arms, Parle, Crean and Hogan from Tumon. They were executed. And then there was a reprisal shooting near Adamstown of three Free State soldiers who were taken out, and they were shot. I'm told on good authority that they were shot by the doctor, Dr. Pack Sinnott of Rocklands in Wexford, that the soldiers who were going to, or the irregulars who were going to execute the Free State soldiers, held back, and Pack Sinnott, who was a doctor, shot the three of them then. And so there was a number of reprisals like that took place, but there was also, because of the war on the railways and that linkage with Dublin, there were a number of Free State soldiers who were killed in Wexford, both in Enniscorthy and in the Killearn area, where they were attacked by Bob Lambert trying to rescue prisoners being brought to Dublin.
Kevin, you want to come in here?
Yes, Tommy. Seeing that this is oriented towards Wexford people, I think it's well worthwhile pointing out that the documentation from Wexford, however much we did or we didn't do, but we certainly contributed lots of documentation. So the brilliant military history website, the amount of accounts there are from Wexford, from Enniscorthy, they're well into the hundreds. The amount then of pension applications that people put in, again, is very, very high. So if anybody who was involved in that period, the Wexford sources are brilliantly available now on that marvelous website, which is so easy to navigate and to use. But there are literally hundreds and hundreds of documents there from Wexford, including a very beautiful, the best map in the whole collection, very beautiful map of Enniscorthy in the 1916 period.
Well, here on the Hedge School, we like it when our listeners are given some homework, and you've done it there very well there, Kevin. Guys, I'm afraid I'm going to have to wrap it up here. We certainly will come back to the discussing the Civil War in more detail, as we will do more generally throughout the country. So I'd just like to thank our speakers here today, Bernard Brown, Ida Milne, William Murphy, and Kevin Whelan. Now, our next two Hedge Schools actually will concern Dublin's Customs House. The second one will be on the burning of the Custom House by the IRA during the War of Independence on the 25th of May 1921. But the first one, a more interesting one maybe, is on the building itself and its controversial conception 230 years ago. So listeners, I hope you can tune in for those. Thank you very much for giving us your attention. Thank you.